If you make that little oof noise every time you stand up, yeah, that's your knees talking. Go see Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief covered by Medicare, 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
A replacement life is bold, ambitious, and wickedly smart. Those are the words of the New York Times, not me, so they matter a little bit more. And I have a feeling they might describe the novel's author, too, Boris Fishman, who joins us. Boris, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. I'm happy to be here.
Well, is that true, then? Are you bold, ambitious, and wickedly smart?
Well, I'm certainly the most objective person to judge, and I would say a resounding yes.
Would you? So I'm interested in the idea of fiction speaking to truth, you know, using fiction to tell truth. And in this book, A Replacement Life, that sort of happens because you've got a character who's writing fiction in a way to understand the nonfiction of his life.
That's right? Exactly right.
But it's all wrapped up in the fiction of a novel.
So that's right.
We're sort of in this rabbit hole.
I wanted to make a cake with as many layers as possible.
But it's true, isn't it? This kid Slava, this young writer, grew up as a Russian emigre in the United States, tries to escape his family in a way because
that's right.
He wants to Americanize. But then to further or to more understand himself, he ends up writing about his ancestors.
That's right. What happens in the novel is his grandmother is a Holocaust survivor. And Slava is vaguely aware that she went through some really dramatic stuff that he ought to know as her descendant. But like many survivors, she's not eager to talk about what happened. She just prefers to put it all behind. Slava, like many of us, means one day to really sit her down and press. And then she dies. And she dies just as she's become eligible to apply for the restitution that the German government has been paying to Holocaust survivors since the 1950s. And so Slava comes to realize that because his grandfather, who was evacuated to safety, pressures him to write a claim anyway.
Right, so his grandmother's not eligible, obviously. She's not living.
That's right.
His grandfather, sort of a rascal, says, well, write one for me.
And Slava tries to object in this sort of high-minded American way that he's trying to adopt as someone who's trying to assimilate. And he says, but you were evacuated. And his grandfather says, you're a writer, aren't you? And Slava initially wants to resist, but then he comes to see in these forged claims an opportunity to invent a grandmother that he never got to know in real life. And so it's this idea that even if a certain opportunity to enrich one's life is no, however that's defined, is no longer available in nonfiction, in the facts, in real life, that doesn't mean that there isn't a kind of liberation awaiting us in the world of fiction.
And so in a way, he's writing her story, even though it's not factually her story.
That's right. That's exactly right. I had someone come up to me at a reading who said they had done something similar with their family history. And this young woman said, I know technically that what I invented was false. She sort of pulled together some bits of blurry family lore, plus read some history books and invented some plausible narratives for what her grandparents might have gone through. And she said, I know technically this is false, but nonetheless, it still has so much emotional value for me.
There's an understanding, right? I mean, there's a written understanding when it comes that way.
And the same thing is true for fiction. Factually false, spiritually true. Picasso said, art is the lie that tells the ultimate truth, or whatever the exact quote is. And there is a kind of deeper emotional, spiritual truth we can arrive at through fiction that isn't always available through non.
So in a way, you know, when someone writes their first novel right away, everyone's like, well, how much of this is you?
Of course. First question at every reading. How much of this is autobiographical?
But a little bit of it is you, right?
I mean, Of course. My grandmother was a Holocaust survivor. The grandfather, the rascally grandfather, temperamentally, if not literally, is based on mine. And most importantly, sort of the questions that Slava is trying to answer as a young man trying to find his way between cultures in his 20s, trying to figure out, what does it mean to be a writer? What does it mean to be a human being? What does it mean to be a man? How Russian am I? How American? These, of course, were my questions in my mid-20s.
Well, right, so that could be any of our stories, though, right?
Yeah.
But you wrote the letter for your grandmother, too, the restitution letter?
That is correct. That is correct, because the kid in the family learns English the fastest. Any immigrant kid listening will recognize that. And so the parents who are trailing behind linguistically, they ask you to sort of come out front and manage all kinds of family affairs that usually 10 and 12-year-olds don't have to manage.
Right.
One of them was my grandmother's restitution claim. And I basically, that was when I finally got to hear some of her stories, when she told me about what she went through for the application.
So did you write the factual account or the truthful fictional account?
No, in that case, well, very unfortunately, in her case, no fictional amplification was necessary
needed, right,
for what she went through. It was pretty horrific, and it's with me to this day.
I'm sorry, I don't have the name in front of me, but you'd written something earlier about your a father and a grandfather. Right? What was the title to that?
I think I had planned to write. Are you referring to the memoir that I had in mind?
I don't know. I'm sorry, Boris. I shouldn't do it this way. But I just remember coming across, maybe on your website, there was a story of sort of a rascally grandfather and a reserved father.
Yes.
And that was nonfiction.
Well, it still remains unwritten. It's a plan that I have for a memoir that, you know, I've always been interested in the question of masculinity. It's changing a lot these days, gender roles. But I don't want to write a sociological book asking what does it mean to be a man in America today. I wanted to tell that story through a kind of triangular portrait of my rascally alpha maternal grandfather, my not very rascally, soft-spoken, but very strong in his own ways father. And then the third pillar is this writer named Jim Harrison, who may be best known to readers as the author of Legends of the Fall, this trio of novellas, who kind of became a secret idol for me because he presented an entirely different idea of masculinity through his books. And I admired him sort of secretly and silently through his books for a very long time. And then at a kind of crossroads in my life, went out to find him in Montana. It was in 2008, and ended up becoming friends with him and spending some days with him out there. And so these men present very different ideas of what it means to be a man, and I kind of wanted to explore them in a nonfiction book.
Well, I got you off track, but the first two you describe also describe the men in this book.
That's right.
The grandfather's a rascal, and the father. The father's pretty reserved and a wallflower.
I mean, the father isn't really the parents are not really present in this book. This is really a book about this conversation between the grandchildren and the grandparents. The parents are sort of mostly, why? Because the grandparents went through something so incredibly dramatic and extraordinary. I'm talking about World War II. It's not something that's been encountered by any generation since. And I think I've got a little extraordinariness envy, like my times are a little too prosperous right. for me to be tested in the way that they were. And of course, that's a blessing. That's what they wanted for us. At the same time, I can't help having questions about how I would hold up in those circumstances.
This book also explores the idea of the Americanized Jew versus the Russian Jew.
Correct.
Right? And so let's do that through Vera and Ariana,
yeah.
The two interests.
These are Slava's love interests, exactly. I mean, the biggest difference between these groups, I mean, American Jews fought very hard to get Soviet Jews released from the former Soviet Union. Then, when they finally met them, they were quite flummoxed because these people define Jewishness completely differently from the way that they
did. They weren't the same, right, they didn't have the same view at all.
To put it very simply, American Jews, for them, religion plays a much larger role in their identity than Soviet Jews, they define Jewishness culturally. Support for Israel, certain kind of food, a certain kind of humor. And they didn't like being told that they weren't Jewish enough by their American brethren because they had lost 17 cousins in the war. You know, they'd been made to suffer quite a bit for being Jewish.
Right.
And so they didn't like that at all. So I think it's a relationship that continues to figure itself out. But to talk about the women, Ariana is Slava's American love interest. Vera is his Russian love interest.
California girl.
Yeah, Ariana is. Yeah. And the great paradox there is with Ariana, Slava could talk until dawn about ideas, about books, about what have you. But he couldn't really bring her to his family's dinner table. She'd be bored and locked out of the language, and she'd be texting on her phone under the table. Whereas with Vera, not only could he bring her to his family's table, she would run the table for the rest of the evening, probably forgetting Slava. But with her, he's got nothing to talk about other than family and maybe the weather.
There is I think you wrote or said too that there's more of a self-loathing with the Russian Jews and American Jews. Explain that for me.
I don't know exactly if I said those words. I just, maybe the best way to put it is there's a certain kind of defensiveness. These are people who were made to feel very bad for being Jewish in the Soviet Union. It was a second-class life there. They were second-class citizens. And so they simultaneously are a little too forceful with it and a little too defensive with it. They're now in a country where Jews are far more accepted than they were in the Soviet Union. And of course, they take comfort in that. But old habits die hard, and they still retain a Soviet mindset in some ways. And that is a mindset where you had to sort of be invisible in some circumstances, defend yourself and others. And it's a traumatized mindset. So more than self-loathing, it's traumatized.
Things change from generation to generation, right? You emigrated here, but in some ways would you consider yourself the second generation of your family here?
I don't know how to call it.
I guess you would be the first, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I'm almost zero because
right.
I was born there.
Right.
I was born there. So I was 9 years old when I came here, and I do feel like I've caught up for lost time.
But do you have that pull, or does your family think you have a pull away from them to become more Americanized?
Yes, without a doubt. I mean, they committed this great sacrifice for me. They left a familiar place for an utterly unknown place to give me opportunities I never had there. But the ironic price tag attached to it is that that guaranteed that I would become so different from them that we sometimes struggle to find what to say to each other. I mean, I'm a very different person psychologically from who they are. And, you know, we'll never allow the bridge to collapse, but sometimes it stretches quite a bit.
There's a story, you say that your mother read this book. And yes. Then sent you a text.
That's right. She sent me a text at 1:30 in the morning. She's the only one in the family who's read it because my father's English is not strong enough and my grandfather doesn't speak any. And she wrote, "Now I understand. You're different from us." And it might sound like a criticism, but actually I read it as a compliment because in a Russian family, very often, the way you convey love is to agree about everything. So for someone to say, "You're different from us," and, you know, implied parentheses, "We still love you."
Right, in a welcoming way.
That was very meaningful. And so she could simultaneously hold in her mind and in her heart the idea that I had turned out very different from them, but was still a person with whom she could have a common language.
That's Boris Fishman. The name of his book is A Replacement Life.